David the Ruthless.
Study weakness, particularly in your friends.
The Master. Mary certainly wasn't ready. The following morning, she listened to her husband's explanation of their unexpected guest's presence with an expressionless face. She made breakfast for Mr. White with the minimum of words and a few tight smiles. Fergus was hammering a football up and down the corridor, a tiny freckled fury in a Celtic shirt, while Callum sat at the kitchen table swinging his feet and eyeing their visitor.
"What's your name?"
"My name is Mr. Murdoch White. I'm a friend of your daddy's."
"That's a silly name. I know you know. Why are you staying in the spare room?"
"I'm in the Labour Party like your daddy.
And we're going to make your daddy a very important man.
Would you like that, Callum?"
"My daddy's already got a head the size of an elephant's arse. That's what Mr. Smedley says. Mr. Smedley's a teacher. And he's a counsellor, Callum," said Mary Petrie, without the ghost of a smile.
But Callum was now in full flow.
"Mr. Smedley's my teacher, and he's a counsellor, and a Disney-like daddy. We call him Mr. Smelly."
"That's a bit rude, young man," said Murdoch White.
"Well, he is smelly. He's got a smelly bum. He says everybody's got a smelly bum, but they don't."
Suddenly concentrating, White pushed his plate away.
"This Mr. Smedley, does he ever touch you, Callum?"
"For goodness sake, Mr. White, let the boy alone,"
said Mary, her face crimson.
"No, he's just smelly, but he rubs his thing. He doesn't think we can see, but we can. He sits behind his desk and he rubs his thing."
Mary gaped. Murdoch White smiled and took out a small notebook from his jacket pocket. At this moment, a bleary Davy arrived in the kitchen. He had a list longer than his arm of people to see, but he had to get down to the office first and check that everything was moving forward. There were still houses to be built. White turned to him.
"So, Councillor Smedley, the teacher. A Labour man, of course. Couldn't be anything else around here."
"Aye, Wally Smedley. Smelly Smedley, the kids call him. Been around for years. No friend of mine, but..."
"Oh, I think you'll find he's going to be a great supporter."
"Wally Smedley, with respect, Mr. White, you don't have the local knowledge. I'm telling you, he's not one of ours."
"With respect, Mr. Petrie, I think you'll find that I do. And that he is.
Just ask your most observant son here."
He left to go upstairs, ruffling Callum's hair as he went.
"I don't like your new friend, Dad."
Davy arrived at the newly built two-story office behind the superstore where his business was now based. Waiting for him on his desk were the minutes of the last meeting of the planning committee, with half a dozen paragraphs highlighted in bright green marker pen. His secretary had left a few must-read emails on his screen. The timber supplies in Alloa hadn't been paid again. The local bank had closed and there was now a useless head office up in Glasgow, but Davy had a private number and spent a stressful but useful few minutes on the phone. A foreman had phoned in sick. One of the bungalows in James Murphy Close was taking in water after the heavy rain. It took him an hour to escape. A routine morning. Success was delegation, he reminded himself. Delegation with just a whiff of fear behind it. Back at the house, Murdoch White had returned downstairs, established that the boys had left for school, and asked for another round of toast. After he'd scraped his plate and she'd made a second pot of tea, Mary finally asked him, with impeccable good manners, how long he hoped to be staying with them.
Well, I've got a life of my own, Mrs. Petrie. I wanted to get back to Arran, but I think I'll stop here for as long as Davy needs me. I have to keep an eye on things, don't I? Just so long as the contest's hanging in the balance. Say, a month.
Mary Petrie was quite a woman. She had taken nervous horses over high stone walls. She'd played on in a hockey match for half an hour with a cracked shin bone. She'd won an essay prize at university by not sleeping for a week. She'd shut her ears to the protests of her distraught parents so she could marry a hairy-assed builder from the grotty little town she now lived in. She'd given birth twice without an epidural, not even gas and air. But in all her long life, Mary Petrie would never do anything as remarkable as she did now. What she did was nothing. She didn't reply, nor did she gasp, goggle, throw the teapot or scream. She just gently replaced a carton of milk in the fridge and began to rub away the marks around the sink. Then,
"A month it is, Mr. White," she said. "If you can stand us, you will eat with the family. But no more smoking in this house, if you please."
Taking her measure, the former Foreign Secretary stood and nodded.
"Here's my proposition, then," he said. "I will stay until your husband has been selected as the prospective parliamentary candidate for Glaikit. On the evening of the general election, I will come back and accept a glass of whisky and light one small cigarette. Agreed?"
"Agreed," said Mary. "And while you're here, you can help the boys with their homework too."
"Your boys, Mrs. Petrie, are very vigorous and seem quite intelligent. But I'm afraid they are beyond help."
When Davy returned to the house, he put his iPad on the kitchen table.
"Mr. White, I've made a kind of wee spreadsheet. All the party members in the five branches who really matter. Here are the ones who I know will back me whatever happens. Here are the ones we need to win over. In the last column, there are just a few notes, nothing much."
"Well, we're off and running then," said White. "I'm going to go down to the council building and sniff around a bit. You can find me at the Wallace Bar at lunchtime."
"The Wallace? That's a bit rough for the likes of you, Mr. White."
"It's where the union boys drink.
At least it was 10 years ago, the last time I passed through this godforsaken hole. And I'm a crusade man myself. Fully paid up. Happened when the bastards gobbled up the draftsman's union. Buy you a pint of 80 shillings if you happen to stop by."
"No, I don't think so, Mr. White. I wouldn't be welcome there."
"But I thought the idea was that you were going to come around with me. You need to be seen by yourself. Make some good, strong one-to-one contacts. If I show up in somebody's front room, I'll be the centre of attention. That's no good. So you go off and do your thing, Mr. Petrie. Unless I'm badly mistaken, you do it very well. And then come down to the Wallace and have a pie and a pint and tell me all about it and meet the boys. I'll have warmed them up nicely for you. Promise?"
And indeed, Petrie had been around long enough to know the drill. When a politician enters a house looking for support, what's the first thing he doesn't do? He doesn't talk about politics. He began with a retired couple, long-standing party members and well-respected in the city centre branch where he had least support.
"No point trying to pull the wool over your eyes. You know why I'm here," he told them at the doorstep.
After he'd been invited in, his eyes flicked desperately around the living room for the photographs. Yes, there they were. A middle-aged couple in the sunshine somewhere abroad. Could be Australia, could be South Africa, but not dressed for a holiday. And another picture of a grinning boy and girl with dirty knees in the sweatshirts of the local school. So, One grown-up child overseas. Don't see them enough. Cost of air travel. Prestwick. And another one who still live nearby, hence the grandkids. The local school. That was the way in.
Those two look a bit older than Mark Callum, but he loves it there. Whose are they?
They're our youngest, Katie's. They're a wild pair, but they're lovely kids. They come around every weekend. The swings, a kickabout in the park. Poor George is going to give himself a heart attack with those kids one day. But you wouldn't have it any other way, would you, George?
George looked uncertain but nodded dutifully.
And didn't I hear that your older girl went off abroad and made something of herself?
Said Davy, guessing wildly.
Aye. She married a computer whiz kid from Dundee, and they're off in San Francisco living the high life. No kids. She Skypes us every week, and that's great, but we hardly ever see her.
Skypey? Didn't have you down as a computer guru, George.
George raised his mottled hound-dog face.
I'm no guru, Mr. Petrie, but even though I'm retired, I haven't got all day. Let's cut to the bloody chase, shall we? You want to be our candidate?
With that, he began to cough uncontrollably.
Aye, I do, because the local hospital's bloody useless, George, and you know it as well as I do, said Davy,
revelling in his own quickness. A quarter of an hour later, after consuming some homemade gingerbread and a mug of tea, David Petrie felt he had them in his pocket. There was always the danger that some big figure from London might arrive and blow them over, but they seemed too prickly and too proud of the town for that. The second home visit was rather harder. Elspeth Cook, stern matriarch, was something of a legend in the local party. Her angry divorce years back had split two branches in bits. She lived in one of the few harled prefabs from the 1940s that were left on the outskirts of Glaikit. The veteran of many Labour conference speeches, she had the uncompromising face of a class war fighter who felt more sure of herself the more she was defeated. Davy felt nervous as he knocked on her door. He barely knew her, and he was all too conscious that he didn't have a plan. The snarl of a terrier, a Westie called Rosa with a nasty nip, greeted him as the door opened.
"Aye, aye," said Mrs. Cook. "Thought you'd be round. Fancy yourself as a politician now, do you, wee Davy?"
The pictures in her crammed, overheated front room told a very different story from those in the house he had just left. An anti-apartheid poster from the 1960s. A framed appeal for support for miners' wives and children from 1982, and a tinted portrait of Keir Hardie. Probably worth a bit. The only personal photograph Davy could see showed an unappealing young woman, her face as expressionless as a bar of soap, wearing steel spectacles. This would be the daughter, Bunty. She was, as they said round here, affectionately enough, a big dafty. Not necessarily educationally subnormal, but profoundly dim. Not much scope for idle banter there. But Elspeth Cook turned out to be not quite what Davy had expected.
Right now, you'll sit down there. You and me have to have a good talk. I've got a new batch of potato scones and a big boiling of tea. So, park your ass. And prepare yourself for fearsome Granny Stalin.
She grinned broadly. A few minutes later, after they had polished off some warm scones dripping with butter, she got down to business.
See, Mr. Petrie, I'm one for the workers. That's the basis of my socialism. Two sides, us and them. You may think that's a wee bit simplistic, but the more I look around, the more it makes sense.
I'm no communist, and I'm certainly no trot.
I know change takes time. But what I can't quite get my head around is why, though you're a nice-looking boy, right enough, I should vote for a boss as our next candidate rather than young Pat Connolly, who's a worker after all. One of us.
Well, I'm scarcely a boss. I started laying bricks for my dad. There isn't a job, electrics, plumbing, joinery, plastering, that I can't do better than most of the lads on the sites.
All I've done is work hard and give work to local men and women who need it.
I've always been on the side of the underdog. But what's so wrong with that?
Come on, son. The way I hear it, you've been sucking up to the councillors and officials for years, just like your dad. And cornering a nice wee profit all round this town. You pay your men the minimum wage, but no much more.
It's a great big new house you've built for yourself. No objective, mind. But you're hardly a proletarian, darling, are you?
Davy put his case again with all the eloquence he had. He made a lot of eye contact and they had some good laughs. But at the end, the redoubtable Elspeth seemed unmoved.
I'll be honest, Pat, I like you more than I thought I would. But I'm voting for Pat Connolly. And I'll be telling the rest of the comrades to do the same.
Davy walked back up the road. He'd deliberately taken the bus rather than driving, and reflected on the size of this blow. Granny Starling was much loved hereabouts. She was a real character, a good woman. There must be a way in. As he stared idly through the bus's grimy windows at the familiar chip shops, charity outlets, and a derelict-looking estate agents, Davy remembered something Murdoch White had said the previous evening.
See, the simplistic view of politics is that it's all about blackmail and arm-twisting. Find a fellow's weak point, scare the living daylights out of him, and you've got him for life. Well, in my experience, that's sometimes true, but it's only part of the story.
Friendship and guilt work even more strongly. Do a guy a favour, and you've got him for a year. Make him do you a favour, and you've got him for 10.
A branch party isn't just a collection of individuals, it's a family, a tiny tribe.
And like any family, it has its feuds and its leaders.
All you need to do is understand the feuds and make your mark with the tribal leader.
Elspeth Cook was certainly the tribal leader. He couldn't let her go. So when he got off at the stop by the council chambers, instead of heading straight to the Wallace, he went in. Bunty. She wasn't handicapped, just good, old-fashioned, stupid. He knew she had a job of a kind at the council. Works, administration. He'd often seen her pale, round moon of a face with two expressionless current eyes and a limp, wet mouth that never closed behind her formidable mother at branch meetings, at the GMC, even at conference.
Can I do this? Can I really go this far? He asked himself.
But he had no choice. He found her quickly enough, sitting behind a Formica desk, staring dully at a computer screen.
Hello, Bunty. Remember me?
Bunty stuck a fat white forefinger into her mouth, licked it slowly, and then took it out and drew it across her jumper. A little lump of goo sat at the edge of her mouth.
Hey, you're Mr. Petrie, right enough. Or you were yesterday. I'm no stupid, you know.
I know that, Bunty. Now, I need to ask you something.
It's possible that in a little while I may become an MP and go down to London.
If I do, I'm going to need a personal assistant. More than a secretary. Somebody to look after the constituency work and keep an eye out for me. I'd like it to be you.
Would I live in London?
Aye, Bunty, you would.
And would I live in a flat?
by myself.
Aye, Bunty, you would.
And would I have money to spend on food and stuff and go about?
Aye, Bunty. Not a lot, but aye.
And, Mr. Petrie, would the work be difficult? Or would you get cross at me? She coloured.
No, Bunty, it wouldn't be hard. And I wouldn't get cross with you.
Okay, then.
They shook hands and he turned to leave, satisfied with his brilliant stroke. Bunty spoke again.
Mr. Petrie, my mum will be dead happy I've got a chance at last.
I'm sure she will, Bunty. I'm sure she will.
Mr. Petrie, are you doing this just to get my mum to vote for you?
Certainly not, Bunty. I'll just need someone I can trust down there.
He didn't suppose that Elspeth Cook would be fooled for a moment. But the strongest binding force on the planet is a mother's love, and she might just go for it. But one further touch was needed. He dialed Elspeth's number, told her what he'd done, and insisted that it shouldn't affect her decision to vote for Patrick Connolly.
"I'll vote for who I bloody want to, you cheeky young man," she replied. "And as I've told you, that's Pat Connolly right enough."
So Davy had lumbered himself with Bunty Cook. If he did ever get elected, he'd have to look at her every day, possibly for years. The sacrifices he made. But although Elspeth Cook continued to proudly speak up for the bus driver Connolly, what she said to her friends about David Petrie won him votes across the local party. Later, he would reflect that she had probably won him the nomination. The Wallace was a proper bar. There was a television only for the football, and although smoking had been banned for years, the walls and ceiling were still stained a dirty yellow-brown, a memorial to the lungs of generations of long-dead drinkers. The barman was young and truculent, a nationalist who made himself deliberately offensive to the overwhelming Labour-supporting customers. They, however, approved of his rudeness. A proper man should never hide his views. The Wallace had been the favoured haunt of the Railwaymen's Union and the Transport and General long before it was inherited by Crusade, whose small offices were only a street away. The district organiser, Douglas McGuinness, a tall, white-bearded Irishman who claimed to be a direct descendant of Wolf Tone, was drinking with Murdoch White. He looked up as Petrie entered.
"So, is this your laddie?"
"Not my laddie, Douglas," said White. "David Petrie here belongs to nobody. It's just that I can spot a winner. I know Pat Connolly's one of the boys, but you might think about a little side bet just in case."
The days of the Union block vote being wielded like trumps had passed during the long Ed Miliband rumpus. And indeed, as the former leader had hoped at the time, many individual trade unionists had joined the Labour Party in their own right. But in Glacket, as in many constituencies, the habit of union solidarity died hard. Shop stewards and ordinary paid-up members would come into the Wallace and scan the union paper to find out what the leadership thought. Crusade had an authority in the town rivaling that of the Kirk itself. Who was their boy? What did Douglas McGuinness want to happen? Murdoch White had used the past hour well. Luckily, Davy had always encouraged union membership among his employees, one eye to the future, and had spoken up in the past against New Labour in ways they appreciated hereabouts. Most of the Crusade members, when it came to the General Management Committee, would vote for Connolly first. But it would be closer than predicted, and many would happily switch to Petrie. And so the first days passed. White and Petrie had drawn up their lists and went around the town ticking off addresses. Lines and arrows connected one member with another. Sometimes White told Petrie to cast a wee bit of bread, So Davy would tell the church minister who took the minutes for a particular branch that, for instance, he'd once been on holiday with Douglas Alexander. Then they would monitor where the story appeared. Who was talking to whom? Another arrow would be drawn on the chart. Eventually, they ended up with a swirling, dynamic and relatively accurate picture of the secret life of Glaikit. The rivalries, the alliances, the drinking buddies and the unofficially extended families. Davy found it all infinitely more interesting than the mundane business of fixing councillors and knowing who'd take a backhander. Though those furtive little felonies also helped to bind in a few who prided themselves on their independence. A fortnight before the final selection meeting, Davy was beginning to allow himself to hope. He had given up drink, apart from the occasional obligatory pint with potential supporters, and was eating less, and all the pounding of the streets had made him fitter than he had been for years. But there were two big problems left. First, Labour rules insisted that at least one woman should appear on the shortlist. And second, the London carpetbaggers were pretty damn impressive. Murdoch White had clear views about how to deal with the woman problem.
In effect, we need to run a couple of our own people. Good enough to be plausible, but not good enough to win on the night.
So they talked up a primary school head teacher with a good party record whose whining nasal voice and invincible self-belief were simply intolerable. And among the candidates from outside the constituency, there was one outstanding woman. She was, in a small way, a celebrity cook and quite well known from the television. A handsome mother of two, she had worked publicly for the Labour cause for years before declaring her hand. To Petrie's surprise, White was very keen to get her through the nomination process.
"But she's damn good," Petrie protested. "I'd vote for her myself."
"No, you wouldn't.
Don't worry."
White drove over to her house himself, right across Scotland to East Lothian. He introduced himself and told her not to worry about the black spot on her record, that she had sent her children to a private school, even though there was an excellent comprehensive on her doorstep.
"The party's changing, and fast. We just want the best possible candidates, so the main thing is to be honest. Tell the whole truth. They'll respect you for it."
And so on the night of the open meeting, when she was asked the traditional last question, "Is there anything in your past that would embarrass the Labour Party if it became known?" she did tell the truth. All of it. And the pile of ballot papers with crosses against her name was embarrassingly small. On paper, two good women had very nearly been chosen for Glaikit. In reality, neither had ever had a chance. That left the Southerners and Connolly. There was one last incident before David Petrie's coronation. Murdoch White had had a brief conversation with the schoolteacher, Smelly Smedley.
"Just a wee word in your ear about what young Callum Petrie's been saying. And I'm afraid he's not the only one."
"It's not a big problem, Mr. Smedley. It's just one of those silly things." This could get right out of control if the head teacher had to be told. "We don't want to make any trouble. We just want Davy to get his chance."
Walter Smedley was in his early 60s and lived with his elderly mother. Divorced, with a daughter long gone, no one knew where, Wally had let himself go, if only on the outside. He was an intellectual. That was no problem. The problem was, he looked like one. His clothes were always slightly stained. His shaving had become erratic, giving his great head an object that seemed crudely carved from sandstone like Samuel Johnson's, an awesome ruggedness. His almost supernatural talent for teaching now flickered only intermittently. Living with his books, He spent sleepless nights and long days caring for an angry, half-blind old woman who no longer knew who he was. The private truth was that Walter Smedley was almost a saint. To Murdoch White, with his famous face, Smedley said nothing, merely nodded his long head. But the following day, he visited the Petries' house after school. With his mother by his side, Callum was asked to repeat what he'd said about the teacher.
"To my face, boy."
The boy flushed, began to whimper, and tearing himself from his mother, ran upstairs. Wally Smedley turned to Mary.
"I wish, Mrs. Petrie, that I had not had to put you through this unpleasant experience. And even more, I wish that your husband was here. What I have to say, I would have preferred to say to him. But I'm not going to demean myself by chasing around town trying to find that..." He stopped himself. He didn't look well, but he continued. "You may know that Mr. Murdoch White, who I gather is working for your husband and indeed living in this house, has approached me with a very unpleasant story about myself. I don't blame Callum or any of the boys. They are only boys, after all. But Mr. White has threatened me that he will spread a disgusting and slanderous untruth."
Mary held up a hand to protest.
"No, Mrs. Petrie. It is worse than that. Please give me a moment. Mr. White has implied that unless I back your husband as our parliamentary candidate, he will go to my headmistress, who is a kind but foolish woman. He appears to think that I have rather more pull in the local Labour Party than I do. If he does spread this horrible story, then I'm sure it must be clear to you that whatever the truth of it, my life will be ruined. I have my mother to think of. You're an educated woman. You may know your Yeats, Mrs. Petrie. He famously lamented that the best lack all conviction while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Good men, weak, bad men, strong, you see. Callum is welcome in my class at any time. He is a clever boy, and I will do my level best by him. But my message to your husband is that I will not, under any circumstances, support him. He didn't even have the courage to blackmail me to my face like a man. Tell him I am my own man still. I have nothing to apologize for. Gossip and be damned. And Mr. Smedley, his balding head still streaked with the rain, belted up his mackintosh, turned on his heel, and left the house. Mary, shaken and impressed, called David to tell him what had happened. He had just been addressing some local Fabians with Murdoch, who said tersely,
"Well, we must act."
They went together to the school. As they were waiting for the headmistress to see them, they shared that day's Guardian quick crossword. Wally Smedley had, it turned out, the most beautiful copperplate handwriting.
"I could not leave her, you see. But thanks to Mr. White, I had to. How could I have stayed? It's all too disgusting, too humiliating. And all completely untrue. Walter Smedley."
He had killed his mother with a shovel, a single blow to the back of the head. Then he must have written his note and left it on the open bureau before walking into his garage and hanging himself with a length of hosepipe. The local press treated it as a tragic mystery and speculated that Smedley had been driven to the edge by the long years of caring. A policeman interviewed Murdoch White and concluded that the note meant nothing. Mary and Davy had glanced briefly at one another and tacitly agreed that this was too deep, too dark to talk about. Later, in the kitchen, Murdoch addressed what had happened.
"No man ever led other men without doing harsh things. What happened was nobody's fault. And I, for one, believe your son."
In bed upstairs, Callum told his dinosaur,
"I just made it up. I don't know why."
He was quiet for a while, but soon pushed the whole matter behind him and was once again the cheeky, happy little boy he'd been before. The selection meeting was perhaps the most exciting few hours of Davy Petrie's life so far. Coached by Murdoch, he made a belter of a speech. Nothing against any of the folk who had made the journey up north, he told the crowded and overheated room.
"But is this the kind of town so thin in local talent we have to hire outsiders? Folk who've never known how cold it is on Glaikit Glen playing a wee bit football. Folk who've never been bawled out for backsliding by our own Granny Starling. Folk who, for whatever reason, couldn't get chosen in their own backyard, so they've come up here to our backyard."
For each of the incomers, he had a carefully prepared line of attack, the result of many hours spent in front of a computer screen over the past weeks. The man from the leader's office had once written a column for the New Statesman in which he'd said that if he'd been a Scot, he'd have voted for independence in 2014. Davy read out the whole paragraph and was gratified by the hissing.
"He's no even a Scot, mind, yet he's a Scottish nationalist."
Another, now working for a trade union in London, turned out to have been briefly a member of the Federation of Conservative Students. Two down. As to Patrick Connolly, the depressed-looking bus driver who was his main local rival, Petrie offered the hand of friendship.
"You all know Pat Connolly. He's carried you up and down this constituency, aye, and your kids too. And I stand here and I tell you that we may be opponents, but that he is a reliable and a decent man. He's not the most cheerful fellow, perhaps, but we could do a lot worse."
As Murdoch White had predicted, Petrie's praise finally sank Connolly. Any candidate who could afford to be so confident and large-spirited clearly had no fear of the former front-runner. In fact, Petrie nearly overdid it. He needed Connolly to come first in the opening round of voting, preferably ahead of the guy from the leader's office. But after Davy had spoken, the London blow-in spent the next 10 minutes saying that while Pat Connolly might be a good bus driver and a decent councillor in a quiet week, he didn't have the oomph necessary to make his mark at Westminster. Then an increasingly upset Connolly savaged the London man back. A jumped-up metropolitan hack from Chelsea or somewhere where a two-bed flat cost more than the entire housing stock of Glaikit, while Petrie stood at the back of the room, handing out mugs of instant coffee, and waiting. Still, as planned, he came third in the first ballot, and as White had predicted, those who just found Connolly a bit depressing and those who couldn't stick the idea of a toff parachuted in from London switched. And on the second ballot, Davy came through triumphantly. He had abused nobody except in jest. He had committed himself to very little. He had held out the hand of friendship to a man he'd thown. Poor Pat Connolly didn't know what had hit him. He seemed dazed and about half the size he'd been at the beginning of the meeting.
"Welcome to politics," said Murdoch White.
"Local boy chosen," crowed the Glaikit Post. At the subsequent election, Davy's campaign literature would show the Petrie family standing together with the slogan, "He's built half of Glaikit. Now let him build a better Britain."